Our next case of the morning is Garcia against Kankakee County Housing Authority. Mr. Boland.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor's counsel, may it please the court. The issue before the court this morning in relation to the claim of Larry Garcia against the Kankakee County Housing Authority deals with the propriety of the district court's grant of a summary judgment in favor of the defendants and against the plaintiffs. This is the issue over a seven-year employee of the Kankakee County Housing Authority, which is an agency of the county, which is indirectly an agency of the state, who after 2 years as a director of technical services, on December 4th of 1998, the director or the chairman of the board and two other members of the board, which consisted then of four persons, came to Mr. Garcia and asked him if he would serve as the interim executive director due to the resignation of the then current executive director. The evidence in this record indicates and supports Mr. Garcia's contention that he said he would based upon the condition that when his services were no longer needed as interim executive director, he would be allowed to return to his job as director of technical services.
Mr. Boland, his job as director of technical services was one that he held as an employee at will, was it not?
It is our position that it was not.
His technical services job?
Was not that position was controlled by a written contract which was based upon...
That's your handbook argument.
That's the handbook argument, that's correct.
But there you run into the page 2 disclaimer in the handbook that there is in fact anything in the handbook that changes the underlying presumption of employee at will. Let me just ask you this. If, for the sake of argument, and I'm not asking you to concede anything, but if for the sake of argument one thought that the director of technical services position was that of an employee at will, then is there any additional value to this alleged agreement that you have that if he left the interim executive director position, he could go back to the director's job?
Yes.
So he can go back to something that the next minute later he can be fired from?
No. The reason that there is value in that agreement is it establishes the property interest, which would then require the pre-termination due process.
But what if they put him back in the director of technical services job and then they say, but now we don't want you anymore? Again, this is all in the assumption that we don't agree with your handbook argument. They can do that, can't they?
That is speculative, and based upon the facts that were developed during the course of this case, there were no board members other than Ruth who would have taken that position.
But why is it speculative? I thought when they fired him from all positions he held with the Kankakee County Housing Authority. I thought they were quite explicit about that, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, they fired him ultimately they did, because that was the position defendant Ruth took. It was not the position, not the motion that was made at the December 22nd meeting.
But look, this federal litigation, it's not our job to determine what motions were made at some proceeding. Almost all of your argument seems to be that your client had some contract right under the law of Illinois. So why isn't this a contract suit under the law of Illinois?
Because
in Illinois court?
Because it deals with a protected right under his constitution.
I think there must be some constitutional mirage that gets lawyers, I think probably in our first case, perhaps in this case as well, to sue in federal court on a constitutional theory, when if they've got any theory at all, it's a perfectly good state law theory. And the major consequence of this pursuit of the constitutional chimera is to surrender the state law theory. And then what might have been a perfectly good claim for relief just goes...
From our position, because there is state action involved, it becomes a constitutional claim. And because there is state action involved via the fact that this is a state agency, and there are certain rights accorded to those who are employees of state agencies.
But if your client doesn't want a hearing, your client wants his job back. And that's not what federal law is going to give him. If you succeed in this case, the most you can possibly get is another hearing.
And
you go to state court and get the job back if you're right.
Well, if I were in state court, that might be a viable option. I'm also entitled, perhaps, to damages as a result of the violation of the constitutional claim. And that's the issue.
The damages for not giving somebody a hearing are $1.
And in addition, he has been terminated from his position, has lost pension rights as a result of the termination of his position, and has suffered as a result of...
There's no federal law claim for breach of contract by a state entity. That's very well established.
Right.
If your claim is really for breach of contract, and that's what your brief is arguing, that's what you're arguing here, you really need to bring a suit in state court alleging breach of contract.
My claim is
It's too late for this point to be made in this case. I'm just puzzled at your resistance to it, but I was puzzled by the position of the litigants in the first case, too, who gave up a slam dunk state law case for a federal chimera.
But what about your First Amendment claim? I mean, let me turn to that for a moment,
yes.
Because you're also claiming the termination was in retaliation for First Amendment rights, which is not so dependent on contract issues. There, my problem is, frankly, you know, the Pickering-Connick test. This man cuts quite a swath through the Kankakee Housing Authority in the 18 days that he's interim director. And when I think, you know, in my own observation of what people who are interim or acting or what have you, whatever the title is to indicate temporary positions, they usually are more conservative. And he came in and did a lot of things that the authority was unhappy with. So I don't see under a Mount Healthy against Doyle kind of analysis why it isn't absolutely clear that he would have been terminated even if he had never, let's say, shown up at the meetings and discussed, Pembroke, the other district, or that he hadn't done some of the things that he did.
First of all, in relation to the actions which he took, which consisted of 4 memos, which were the subject of the dispute, ultimately 2 memos, because it, based upon the evidence, there was a meeting at an apartment of the board members between 3 board members less than a week after his employment to terminate his employment. But the memos he was requested, the evidence established two of the board members, Hess and Schmidt, had requested him to document the activities of the chairman and make sure that the board was aware of what the chairman was doing.
So why is that a matter of public concern? Why isn't this an intramural dispute, perhaps a power struggle between the chairman and the director, whatever? Why isn't it an internal matter? Because you need to make it be an issue of public concern before we get even to first base in it.
This agency was in total chaos. It had been in total chaos for more than a year.
That's clear.
That may be true.
This board had been put in place in February of 1998 when the entire previous board had been ordered to resign. In the course of a 6-month period, they went through 4 directors. Not just Mr. Garcia, but other directors as well. Mr. Garcia...
But the question you're being asked is, what does that have to do with the First Amendment? It may be in chaos now, but if we said that for some reason the First Amendment gave the executive director tenure vis-a-vis the board, chaos would be even worse.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that his conduct is protected by the First Amendment for 2 bases. One, it was for a public purpose. It was a public issue. The chaos that the board members themselves were attempting to correct.
So what?
Well,
your client, if one understands his position, looks very much to be a policymaker. Indeed, that was his claim, that he was entitled to make certain kinds of rules to the exclusion of the board. And if that's right, then under Elrod against Burns, it doesn't violate the First Amendment to reach out and say, I am firing you because of your position on issues of public concern.
My client never...
The President of the United States could fire the Attorney General tomorrow morning because he doesn't like what the Attorney General said in his last press conference.
My client on these issues is not suggesting he's a policymaker. He is reporting activity to board members and to all the board members. The memo is with...
I don't know how the executive director of a public agency could be anything other than a policymaker.
When
Attorney General Ashcroft gets fired, he can't say, look, I'm not a policymaker, I'm just carrying out acts of Congress.
My suggestion as to the issues before this court on this case are the issues that it is claimed that it is not public, not protected by the First Amendment, deal with two memoranda, which are conceded to be true.
It doesn't make any difference if he's a policymaker what the memoranda concern. If the President fires the Attorney General because he wrote an op-ed piece in favor of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which is under attack by Christian fundamentalists, he could be fired for that, even though it doesn't have anything to do with the Attorney General's job.
And without... I don't intend to get in the business of defending Harry Potter or John Ashcroft, but the point I do want to make is that the conduct of Larry Garcia was a public purpose and was for the purpose of improving the efficiency.
And the more you say that, the clearer it is that under Elrod, your client can be fired.
And was for the purposes of improving the efficiency of that agency. And that meets the test to establish that it is protected under the First Amendment.
And I just don't get it. When the head of an agency says, I'm doing something to deal with the policy of this agency and the way we conduct our operations, it just sets off the response that policymakers can be fired on account of their speech.
And I think I've addressed that issue as best as I can, as best that I can address it. It is our position that Mr. Garcia had a property interest at the time that he was terminated. It is our position that he had the right to a pre-termination hearing at the time that he was terminated. And had such a hearing been held based upon the evidence that was adduced in discovery, it may very well have been we would not be here today.
Do you, somewhere I remember reading that he got paid up until the January date after the, as it were, post-termination hearing. Is that correct?
That occurred after the post-termination hearing.
He was paid from December to January, whatever it was when there was...
His pay was stopped December 23rd. On January the 28th, after the post-termination hearing, they did provide that he would be paid from December the 23rd through, I believe, January 22nd was the date of the hearing.
Okay, that helps.
On the basis of these positions, it's our argument that, number one, he had the right to a pre-termination hearing, which was never accorded, and secondly, because these actions were taken in retaliation against him for his exercising his First Amendment rights, that the action was in violation of his right of due process. The issues of whether he was terminated for cause are, we contend, all factual issues, and we point out the factual issues that arise both within the record and even amongst the board members themselves. In most of the instances, and it's important to note, that the board chose to terminate him for cause. This is not an at-will termination. They, in the notice of his termination, pointed out that he was being terminated, and this was the information pursuant to the employee handbook, and if he wanted a grievance hearing, he could do that pursuant to the employee handbook. So for the agency to suggest now that this was a termination at will is simply contrary to their own action, and we submit contrary to the employee policy handbook. Based upon that, we are asking you to reverse the summary judgment decision of the district court, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Mr. Sherman.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. We all know that saying that you have a cause to terminate an employee does not abrogate the employer's entitlement to terminate an employee at will. Many employees who can be terminated at will are provided with the opportunity to understand what it was that led to that termination decision. That was, in fact, what is involved here.
Is that how you reconcile the two statements in the employee handbook, because although we do have on page 2 of the handbook a pretty strong statement that it's really just a handbook and it's not a contract and so on and so forth, then later on there is the termination provision in which the authority retains the right to terminate an employee for just cause, which strikes one as utterly superfluous if you believe everything on page 2, and then various procedures. And I was having a little trouble seeing how those made sense together.
Allow me to respond very quickly. There's a couple of things that are going on at the same time. This is an agency that has been in existence for quite a long time. What policies were and how policy manuals developed were amended from time to time and changed and so forth, both to conform with the law, conform with HUD regulations, and conform with what their internal local enactments were. That is one of the reasons that accounts for that, what appears to be a dichotomy here, which is, on the one hand, you say for cause, we retain that right. On the other hand, in the purpose statement, you say X. What is also going on here, however, is that clearly the statement here, and I believe that both the Illinois cases from Dodelau and his progeny and also the Seventh Circuit cases that discuss this issue, clearly say the fact that a handbook mentions that there may be cause or a discussion of cause or a presentation, even post-termination of cause and so forth, doesn't affect the at-will nature of the employment. So long as the disclaimer is present, so long as it is there, open, available to the employee, notorious in the sense that when reading the disclaimer in light of the entire document, they can understand this is not intended to be a contract. It is our position that the case law is quite clear. You cannot read that language further on in the handbook without having already gotten to the purpose clause on page 2 and understood nothing here was intended to create a contract, intended to give a property right, as the Constitution would indicate, to this employee. So what I'm saying is you don't have to say there is a plain reason why it occurred. There is a reason why it occurred, and I'm sure that it's not in the underlying record because it wasn't an issue that was raised by the party.
Right, no, my concern is whether the manual is just so ambiguous about whether there is or isn't a property right in this job that one would need to look further.
I am aware of Your Honor's thought and also of the cases, including the Kwan's decision and other decisions in the Seventh Circuit, where issues of ambiguity have arisen. And in fact, in the lower court, not the lower court, if you will, in the Illinois court, the discussions in the long
think of them as lower.
In the long case, in the Methodist Medical Center case, in those types of cases where there were ambiguities, but in those cases the courts dealt with something very specific, and I think a thread that ran through those decisions. In those decisions, the disclaimers were, as they put it, hidden. They were buried in language. Even in the Mitchell case, which is cited by my opponent, when they discuss the issue, it's in that probationary language. Does the probationary employee become the at-will employee, and then afterwards, is there cause necessary for the employee to be terminated? In this instance, we don't reach the ambiguity issue, I don't believe, on the face of the document. We have a situation, as the lower court decided here, the district court, decided that there was a clear and open and unmistakable disclaimer. And the unequivocal language of that disclaimer prevents anything else in this document. If there was something contradictory in the sense that it said, ignore anything we said before, just cause is necessary for these types of terminations, I would agree with you, perhaps, that ambiguity is an issue here we have to deal with. I don't think the court needs to address this issue. The underlying case here, and my position with regard to the district court's opinion, is that not only did Garcia have a full and fair opportunity to present his arguments and to present the issues, but that the district court, in several opinions that are attached and appended, in fact, to the appellant's brief, there is a very distinct explanation of why the district court did exactly what it did. The first issue that it reached, of course, was the handbook issue, and the issue of whether or not, in any sense, there is a property right here. I think that decision in itself, and the decision that had earlier been made on the motion to dismiss, that there was, in fact, no property interest, there was a clear disclaimer, was the right one. The court, of course, had to deal with the oral contract issue and what was intertwined there, the implied contract issue. All right? What was said to Garcia, as alleged by Garcia, that may have boosted him up to a property right, a contract that was clear and unmistakable. And under the court's decision, the prior court's decisions here, we know that it must be a clear and definite promise. and nothing in the evidence, and that's what I look to most importantly, nothing in the evidence spoke to Larry Garcia being promised, A, that he would be returned to the Director of Technical Services position, B, that he would be promised continued employment for an indefinite period, or C, continued employment absent just cause for termination. And those are really the keys that go straight to the heart of the oral contract, the implied contract issue. There was a question, and it's raised in my opponent's brief, and we deal with that issue, and that was whether or not by the affidavit of Tyler Prude, which we moved to strike on the summary judgment motion, was appropriate and could itself constitute enough to bring the issue of a contract, a just cause termination contract, into this case. Tyler Prude's affidavit is very important. The court denied my motion to strike that affidavit, but considered it and said it would only consider that evidence arising from the affidavit that was in fact credible and properly admissible before the court. Prude's affidavit is important because nothing in Prude's affidavit tells us when he purports to be providing service as executive director. Who is it, if anyone, that he doesn't tell that they're an employee at will? He just simply opines, I never told anybody they were an employee at will. Well, the manual speaks to that. He doesn't have to speak to that, and obviously he didn't give any decision, any statement about when those occasions may have arisen.
Can I maybe introduce a slightly different topic?
Sure.
Just because I think the contract issue is something we've discussed enough. With respect to the First Amendment point and the meetings that Mr. Garcia attended, was he, were the meetings of concern meetings that he attended before or after he became interim director?
My understanding is that the underlying evidence, had the court reached that, would be that at least one of those meetings had occurred prior to him taking the role of the interim executive director, but then there had been communications and meetings that were the subject of Roosh's concern that happened after he took that position.
And had he been given, because I understood that he had been participating in this group in the other place for quite some time in his earlier capacity, and that he may not have understood that simply to go to the meetings was all of a sudden, even though it had been his job before, now something that was forbidden. Was he given any guidance about that?
My understanding was that the evidence, and it was, I believe it's supported not only in the record, I believe it is the number 76 in the appellate record, which is the summary judgment motion, and attached there to the Roosh affidavit, discusses the fact that Roosh told him no, not to attend the meeting and not to represent himself at those meetings as person speaking on behalf of the authority, because that was something that Roosh, as chairman of the board, felt was a position that he was going to take, or he would appoint someone else from the board to do that, and in fact to engage in those discussions. That was very clearly to me.
He got the timing shows that that direction came from Roosh before.
I believe that's true, yes. I believe that that's what the effect of the Roosh affidavit, and if the court looks to the underlying attachments to that affidavit, I believe that that's also contained in there. And it was available for the district court. The issues here span from procedural to substantive due process and so forth. I believe with regard, staying with for a moment, the First Amendment issues. The memos, those issues, I think the court has addressed it and perhaps considered those issues, and I don't think that it requires a great deal of other comment, except to this one point. Assume for the moment that there was a public concern. If there's a thread at all that runs through the memos, if there's a thread at all that leaves the court with a concern about Pembroke and what it was that the extension of the Housing Authority services were to be there and so forth, the question would then come again in the nature of Matthews versus Eldridge, what type of balancing takes place, what type of issues do we look to discuss exactly what the interest of the Housing Authority is, and does that interest outweigh any interest of Garcia in speaking out? I think that it's clear, Your Honors, that number one, Garcia was not speaking out as a public individual. Number two, these were issues that were clearly between him and Roosh that demonstrated that there was animosity. There was a row back and forth between the two of them. The question, of course, comes, what was the form, the nature, the context in which these alleged First Amendment statements were made, and whether or not the interest of the Kankakee County Housing Authority in taking the action that it did outweighed the interest of Larry Garcia. Under the circumstances, considering the fact that this was a private matter, that Garcia was seeking to inject his own thoughts about what Roush's involvement was and whether or not that was appropriate and whether he liked it and so forth, clearly the KCHA's interest outweighs. Viewed another way, of course, the question, and I think Your Honor pointed out so appropriately, is the federal court the appropriate forum in which to review the decision in this case based on this type of expression? As to all matters, we believe that everything that has been discussed to date by the court, everything that is in the brief, adequately addressed the issue. There are no issues of constitutionality with regard to property interest, in our opinion, with regard to the contract. And as to any First Amendment issues, we believe that those have been handled. The question that I would have for Your Honors, and again, this is addressed in my opponent's discussion for a moment. In the event that there was an alleged First Amendment issue, what type of injury, what type of resolution would have been appropriate? There was, in fact, a name-clearing hearing following. Garcia had a full and fair opportunity to have notice of the charges, to be available, to testify, to cross-examine witnesses, and so forth. And that also is true as well with regard to the liberty interest claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Anything further, Mr. Bowen?
Justice Woods, you raised the issue of the meetings attended. All of the meetings that Mr. Garcia attended for which he was subjected to discipline had been attended prior to the time that he was the interim executive director. There was a meeting at which Mr. Roush saw Tina Puroy at a meeting and asked why she was there, and he said because Larry, she told him because Larry could not be there, and based upon that, he was upset that Larry would have been there. However, these are all issues of fact that have been raised because each of the other board members said it was entirely appropriate that Larry Garcia, and they expected him to be at those meetings both before he was the interim executive director and afterwards. So for Roush, for the Housing Authority to say, no, the only evidence is that he should not have been there, there is at least contradictory evidence and a material issue of fact on that issue. And the second issue deals with the argument that there was no clear and definite promise. I would submit that the evidence shows that there was a clear and definite promise in that if you want, I will take this job on condition that when you no longer need my services, I will be returned to the other job. And two of the board members agree that was the agreement that was made. We submit that the evidence is sufficient to defeat the argument or the defeat the granting of the motion for summary judgment and ask the matter be reversed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.